The Book Nook on WYSO is presented by the Greene County Public Library with additional support from Clark County Public Library, Dayton Metro Library, Washington Centerville Public Library, and Wright Memorial Public Library.
Hello, welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis. I'd like to welcome to the program today Bill McKibben. He joins us on the telephone in Vermont. Hello, Bill.
Hello, Vic. How are you?
Doing just fine, Bill, all things considered.
Yes.
You have a new book out. It's called The Flag, The Cross, and The Station Wagon. A graying American looks back at his suburban boyhood and wonders what the hell happened. That's quite
a
title.
Very long subtitle. Yes.
What did happen, Bill?
Well, I mean, look, I'm in my 60s now, and so this was probably as close as I'm going to get to writing a memoir about the early days of my life, which I'd always avoided doing because it was quite boring and normal. But I've come to think in the world we inhabit at the moment that sort of boring is the new exotic, you know? And going back to that period of relative stability and calm and solidarity is kind of frightening at the moment. I mean, we live in a society at the moment that seems to be marked by mass shootings, record heat waves, and politicians who refuse to do anything about them, even though there's wide public support for getting something done. That's a strange place to inhabit, and I think that some of the roots of where we are were sown back in that period 40 and 50 years ago when we were making some pretty fateful choices. The most important of those choices, and the one that in certain ways came straight out of the suburbs, was the choice between a world where we looked out for each other in one way or another, the world that had emerged from the Depression and the Second World War, and by contrast, the world of a kind of hyper-individualism, exemplified by bigger houses ever farther apart from each other, and made real by the election of Ronald Reagan and the notion that greed was good and that markets would solve all problems and all we had to work on was getting rich.
In the book, you talk about this town where you grew up and how they had a ballot issue that was crucial, and you look at why that issue failed and how that made the community more insular and less open to people that didn't fit in.
Yes, it's absolutely right. I grew up in an interesting town, Lexington, Massachusetts, the birthplace of American liberty, site of the first battle of the American Revolution. And in 1971, when I was 10, the townspeople voted on a modest proposal for some affordable housing in town, for one development that wouldn't be just everyone with their own driveway and their own backyard, but some multifamily housing that would have been affordable to some people of lower income in the greater Boston area. And even though everybody in town, all the official groups, the Chamber of Commerce and everybody supported it publicly, it went down to defeat 2-1 when people voted in a referendum. And I'm afraid that was a real mark of where the country was going. It wasn't long before we were having tax revolts like Proposition 13 in California. A kind of selfishness was settling over things. And that selfishness, you know, in some ways worked out all right for the people in suburbs like Lexington who kept on getting richer as housing values appreciated. But it has not worked out well for the society in which we live.
How did we become this society that despises intellectualism?
Well, that's an interesting question and an interesting way of putting it. I think that it's linked in certain ways to this same discussion of individualism and a certain kind of selfishness. The people who told us that this wasn't a good idea, we didn't want to listen to. And they tended to be people with wide experience in the world, people who had studied history and looked at it, could sense where we were headed, people who were really open to other cultures, other races, and who were willing to say so, so on and so forth. But, you know, something else happened in these years that I think is really important and people haven't written or talked about enough, and that was the rapid decline of the kind of dominant church in our country, the mainline Protestant church, that in the 60s represented more than half of all Americans. They were Methodists, Lutherans, Episcopalians, Congregationalists, so on. They're now only about 15% of the population. And that consensus kind of liberal mainline Protestantism, I think, was an important bulwark of all kinds of things, including a commitment to education and learning, and to have it replaced in too many cases by an evangelicalism that insisted on that creation was, you know, evolution wasn't real or whatever. That was another one of the things that began to make it difficult for us to carry on the conversations we need to have.
A lot of those mainline churches were places where the term social justice was not a bad thing.
That's right. I mean, in the 60s, those churches and the ministers and things who occupied them were often the people who were, you know, marching with Dr. King or whatever it was. Not all of them. I mean, you know, it was a big, broad consensus church that represented the big, broad culture, and some of that was much too timid and so on. But it's not like the Christianity that's replaced it, which is intolerant and often uninterested in social justice of any kind. Even though social justice seems mostly to have been what Jesus was interested in.
Mm-hmm. My guess is Bill McKibben. His book is The Flag, the Cross, and the Station Wagon. A Graying American looks back at his suburban boyhood and wonders what the hell happened. He joins us on the telephone in Vermont. You just mentioned Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Let's talk about reparations.
Sure. Talk about the suburb that I was, in fact, the house that I grew up in. My parents bought it in 1970 for $30,000, which would be the equivalent of about $200,000 in today's money. But instead, when it was last sold 2 years ago, I guess, it netted $1 million. That $800,000 was the kind of unearned increment that came from being in the right place at the right time. A place that, as you know, African Americans often weren't allowed to be or didn't have the means to be at the beginning of that, not through any lack of their own, but through from decades or centuries of policies that had impoverished them. And so to me it makes sense when we start talking about the need to pay some of that back. You know, black Americans have gotten steadily poorer in relation to white Americans, which is a tremendous problem and a tremendous sin. But those aren't the only kind of reparations. Those same suburbs poured incredible amounts of carbon into the atmosphere.
Mm-hmm.
And that carbon, Americans have put almost a quarter of all the carbon that's in the air, far more than any other country. And that carbon sits up there for more than 100 years, so all that stuff from my childhood is now what's heating the planet. And its effects are felt most by the poorest and most vulnerable, by people who've done nothing to cause this problem. Africa, the entire continent, has put about 2% of the carbon that's in the atmosphere up there. And yet they're the ones dealing with the most severe consequences so far. So there are other kinds of debts that need to be repaid. We're a country of enormous wealth, and not only can we afford to pay some of these debts, we really can't afford not to, because if we can't come to a kind of global consensus, a global cooperation on this stuff, then we're never going to be able to deal with it. That's why they call it global warming.
Bill, I think many members of our audience are familiar with your advocacy on behalf of environmentalism and your outspokenness on the change in climate. And we seem to be going completely in the opposite direction under President Trump. It's just unbelievable.
Yes, unbelievable is the right word. And we're not going very far in the right direction now, though Biden is clearly trying. That's why we're now doing a lot of organizing for older Americans, people like me over the age of 60. We're calling it Third Act, and the two things we work on that are closely related are voting rights and voter suppression and climate change. These seem like the existential problems that our generation needs to play a role in solving. You know, on the climate stuff, I've done a lot of work with young people over the years. We founded 350.org, the first global grassroots climate campaign with myself and seven college students. And I've gotten to work with, you know, wonderful people like Greta Thunberg and all the people like her, junior high and high school students across the world. But it really is a bit much to demand that 17-year-olds solve the biggest problems we've ever faced, that they save the planet in between, you know, algebra homework and field hockey practice. Mm. They need some help from the rest of us. And so we're enjoying delivering that help. There are people in Third Act all over the country who are marching with young people who are standing up to the big banks that fund the fossil fuel industry. We're uniquely qualified to do that, fair or not. The boomers and the silent generation above them ended up with about 70% of the country's financial assets, compared with about 5% for millennials. So if we want Wall Street to take notice and change, we're probably going to have to march. And that's what we're doing. We hope people will join in at thirdact.org. It's a lot of fun, actually, to be taking the skills that people have acquired over a lifetime and bringing them to bear on the issues that will decide their legacy.
You're listening to 91.3 WYSO. It's the Book Nook, fact-based journalism in service of democracy. My guest is Bill McKibben. We're talking about what is essentially a memoir, in a way, The Flag, the Cross, and the Station Wagon. A grain American looks back at his suburban boyhood and wonders what the hell happened. And, Bill, you've got it divided into sections, The Flag, the Cross, the Station Wagon. The Cross, you, as you mentioned, have come out of a mainline Protestant church. You're still active, correct?
Yes, I'm a Methodist.
And it's a dwindling number of Americans that are involved in these churches, isn't it?
Absolutely. Although I will say that the last couple of years, interestingly, the number seemed to stabilize and even grow a tiny bit, and it's now evangelicalism that seems to be in the steepest decline. But these churches, like the Methodists, are a shadow of their former selves, and that's, well, I mean, in certain ways that's troubling, and in certain other ways perhaps it frees us to be countercultural instead of cultural, and to really be able to bring the message of the gospel where it needs to go.
These founding fathers who were at places like your hometown of Lexington back during the American Revolution, when they created this government, one of the key issues was the separation of church and state. And I cannot remember a time in my life where I've ever seen so much advocacy for blurring those lines and those distinctions and trying to turn this into some sort of a religious nation by government.
Yes, in fact, there have been congressional candidates this year who've been demanding that we have a theocracy. And that's not the role of churches or religious people. The role is to remind people of what we're called to do in this world, to clothe the naked and feed the hungry and take care of the sick, and to figure out how we can do that together, which is one of the roles of government. But yes, we we need more values and less ideology in our leadership, I think.
I know this isn't really something you cover in the book, but it's very current. And as we are recording this interview, we've just had two very horrific recent gun violence incidents, mass
yes.
shootings. We cannot even get our gun thing under control in this country.
Yeah, and that's emblematic of the democratic dysfunction that's taken over our political system. Small d democratic. There are large majorities, nearing 90% of Americans, who want universal background checks, for instance, on people buying guns, so that we keep crazy people and ideologues and hateful ideologues from being able to massacre huge numbers of people. You would think that 90% would translate into actual action, but it doesn't, even any more than the 70% of Americans who want strong action from the government on climate change translates into action. Special and vested interests are able to tie things up, and they'll continue to do so unless we figure out how to organize movements big enough to stand up to them. That's, of course, why we're doing things like Third Act.
When the Capitol was invaded on January 6th. You write in your book that rioters were carrying signs saying Jesus 2020 and Christ is King. How did we get so mixed up?
Well, I mean, that really is the $64 question, isn't it?
Uh-huh.
And it feels, I think, strongest for people like me who remember a different time. Not a perfect time, I'm thinking back to my boyhood in this book. So, we were winding down Vietnam, but winding up Watergate and so on. There were plenty of very difficult things going on. But there wasn't the same sense that people had just become willfully unable to pay attention to reality. I was very struck by what happened in the pandemic here. It's true and worth bearing in mind that 60 or 65% of Americans did their best to help their neighbors to do the right thing and so on, and we should not let go of that. But it's also true that a very significant and noisy minority of Americans were able to screw that all up in ways that would have been incomprehensible in my childhood, when everyone happily lined up to get their polio vaccine.
Mm-hmm.
I think what happened was a kind of hyper-individualism that told us that our only job was to think about ourselves, and if we did, everything else would work out okay. But everything else hasn't worked out okay. Ronald Reagan, his laugh line for many years in his speeches was, "The nine scariest words in the English language are, I'm from the government and I'm here to help." Well, ha, ha, ha. I mean, it turns out the scariest words in the English language are things like, "We've run out of ventilators," or, "The hillside behind your house is on fire now."
Mm.
And those are things you don't solve, by yourself. Those are things you solve if you have a working society and a working government. And, I give a lot of credit to Joe Biden for trying to get us back in that direction. But, man, is it hard. It's over every effort of every, of too many senators and too many ideologues who want to get in the way.
In your book, you talk about, in the section of the station wagon, about when Jimmy Carter tried to put a solar panel on the White House. This is quite educational.
Yeah, it's an amazing story. Jimmy Carter did put solar panels on the White House in 1980 or 79. And even more importantly, he put forward a proposal as part of his 1980 campaign that the U.S. would be 20% solar by the year 2000. Had we done that, we didn't even know about climate change yet at the time. We just knew we were in an energy bind. But had we done that at the time, you know, we'd be well on the way to solving climate change now. And that's one of the reasons why that election with Ronald Reagan was so fateful. He immediately took those solar panels off the roof of the White House because solar energy was for sissies. And, you know, real men set things on fire if they wanted energy.
Mm-hmm.
It's, you know, we're now at the point where the folly of that couldn't be clearer. I mean, we've melted the poles. We're raising the ocean. And we're also at the point, finally, back where Carter wanted us and where we could have gotten much earlier, where solar power and wind power are now the cheapest ways of generating power on planet Earth. We really are at the point where, if we wanted to, we could bring combustion more or less to an end on this planet, stop burning things, and rely on the fact that the good Lord put a large ball of burning gas 93 million miles away in the sky.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, there are hopeful things about the moment that we're in, many of them provided by great engineers and scientists. But we're going to have to seize that moment if we want it to matter.
Here in Yellow Springs, it's one of those rare communities in rural Ohio where you see a lot of homes with solar panels. Antioch College has a solar array outside the, the college. And we currently have a issue here in our community where a developer is buying or actually renting a lot of farmland, and they want to install solar panels, quite a massive array all around the area here. And it's controversial. Do you have any thoughts?
It's controversial, you know, and in part because we've been trained to look at the world in a particular way. And I don't know what's being grown on that land, but let me give you an example.
Mm-hmm.
I just saw the numbers for Iowa. 60% of the corn crop in Iowa is now used for ethanol. In essence, they're growing gasoline. And it's an incredibly inefficient way to do it. If you put solar panels on 1% of those fields and then tied the solar panels to electric vehicles, you'd get the same amount of mileage that you get out of growing all that gasoline. Farmland's really important, but one of the most important crops we could be growing is electrons because we use a lot of them.
Mm-hmm.
Up here in Vermont, where I live, it's a dairy state, and so the corn that we grow is mostly used to feed cows to produce milk. But we've got more milk than we need, and we've got fewer electrons than we need. And truthfully, if you think about corn in that way, it's just another kind of solar collector, except that you have to dump a lot of nitrogen on it to make it grow, which then washes into our streams and lakes and things. I think that there's an argument to be made for growing some of our electrons close to home, providing stable income for farmers. And you know what? If we don't need it in 25 years, well, that soil has lain fallow all that time, which is a good thing, not a bad thing for soil.
Well, you've just given me a good bit of information there. These, of course, are your typical Midwestern corn, soybean rotations, I think, going on in these fields. So, yeah.
Yeah.
I didn't realize that ethanol was the main use. I just assumed that they were shipping all that corn to feed cattle in Nebraska or
something. Well, they may well be out of Ohio. And again, you know, it's a good example of ways that we could be using what agricultural land we have to feed people considerably more directly.
Okay.
You know, we do have to take the food crisis very seriously, especially right now, because the combination of bad weather and the war in Ukraine are going to drive food prices through the roof this year. But that's different than ethanol, and it's even really different than Nebraska beef. We've got enough land that we can grow the electrons we need and the calories that we need, but probably not enough to waste it.
My guest is Bill McKibben. We're talking about his book, The Flag, The Cross, and the Station Wagon. A graying American looks back at his suburban boyhood and wonders what the hell happened. And you close the book out with a section called people of a certain age. And Bill, I think you and I are both at a certain age where we're kind of looking back and we're saying, okay, what is our legacy? What have we done? Have we done any good?
Yes, and that's a great question. The way I would break it down is like this, Vic. In our first act, we were around to either participate in or bear witness to really profound social, cultural, political transformations. The anti-war movement, the height of the first civil rights movement, the birth of women's liberation movement, the first Earth Day in 1970, which had 20 million Americans in the street and almost immediately led to the passage of the Clean Air and the Clean Water Acts. So that was an amazing first act. In our second act, taken as a whole, many noble exceptions, I'd say it's probably fair to point out that we may have been more preoccupied with consumerism than citizenship. Mm. And that was that kind of Reagan legacy, I think. But that water is well under the bridge, and now we emerge into our third act with skills over a lifetime, with resources, as I say, most of the country's financial assets. We have time, which we may not have had before, and we've got kids and grandkids in many cases, and hence a really powerful reason to worry about our legacy. And that's what's combining to produce all this remarkable explosion of organizing we're seeing at third act. And I will add that one of the things that makes it really fun, Vic, is that many of the cultural icons from that first act are still around and still engaged. Fight me if you will, but I think we had the best music there ever was.
Mm.
And, you know, so it's been really fun to get to work with Carole King and Bette Midler and Patti Smith and Neil Young and on and on and on to try and mobilize people for this fight.
Wow. Patti Smith and Neil Young, you got me.
There you go.
Oh, Patti Smith, she's really turned into something, hasn't she?
She's amazing. I got to MC the Glasgow Climate Conference in the fall. I got to MC her concert, which was a big climate production and really fantastic. And then she called me back out on stage with a few other people for the final number, People Have the Power. So
uh-huh.
That was, you know, it was fun to be out there rocking with her, gotta say.
You got to perform in the song with her?
Perform would be stretching it, but clap my hands in the background anyway.
For some reason, that was like a kumbaya moment for me to hear that. Well, Bill, I'm sorry it's been so long since we did our last interview. It was probably 20-some years ago, but I appreciate the fact that you remembered it. And
well, we're both still at it, which is the important thing. And, Vic, many, many thanks for a good talk.
It's been my pleasure, Bill. The book is The Flag, The Cross, and The Station Wagon. A Grain American looks back at his suburban boyhood and wonders what the hell happened, written by Bill McKibben, who's been my guest on the program today, Bill. And I hope I talk to you again before another 20 years goes by. Because
I think we better do it before 20 years is out in my case, because otherwise you might not make it.
I think
take care, good friend.
We would be doddering through that interview.
There you go.
Thank you, Bill.
All right.
For the Book Nook, I'm Vic McCunis. Thanks for tuning in.